welcome to NC Spin, an unrehearsed discussion about issues of interest to North Carolina. Now here's the host of NC Spin, Tom Campbell.
Thank you for joining the Valentine's edition of NC Spin. Can you tell I'm dressed for it? Well, we've got lots to share with you, starting with asking what's going to happen to Silent Sam now that a judge threw out the deal. We'll then discuss how to improve the governance of our public universities and what the state should do with a $1 billion surplus. And, of course, we're going to ask the panel to tell us something we don't know. This week's panel includes Bev Perdue, former governor of North Carolina, John Hood, syndicated columnist and author, Rob Schofield, director of NC Policy Watch, and Joe Mavridic, former House Speaker. We begin our uninterrupted debate after these brief messages from our underwriters.
Today's tools make you a real DIYer, and as a member of an electric cooperative, you have lots of valuable tools to help you do it yourself in controlling your home energy use and budget, leaving you free to be dad.
The big issue in 2020 is healthcare. Let's talk basics. You are the key to your own personal health, but there is strong evidence that if you have a relationship with a family physician, your quality of life will be better. You'll likely live longer, and you'll have 33% lower healthcare costs. Your family doctor knows you, has your medical history, and can quickly diagnose health problems. Family Physicians, your trusted healthcare advisor for life.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com.
We now return to NC Spin.
Well, before we get started, I need to make a correction. I pretty well botched up last week when we were talking about the candidates and the campaigns, particularly on the 11th Congressional District. Let me see if I can get this correct and get them right. I want to. Let's see. In the Democratic primary, we had Mike O'Shea, Philip Price, Steve Woodsmall, Gina Collins, and Mo Davis. Which of these appears, John, to have the advantage as far as you're concerned?
Well, there's not any public polling or anything, but Price was the nominee in virtually the same district in 2018. So I would think he has a bit of an edge. He's been on the ballot before.
Now, over on the Republican side, we got a gaggle of candidates. Joey Osborne, Vance Patterson, Albert Wiley, Charles Archer, Linda Bennett, Matthew Burrell, Madison Cawthon, Jim Davis, Dan Driscoll, Steve Keat, Dylan Gentry, and Wayne King. Whew. I get fatigued reading it. So last week we talked about those.
We talked about Bennett, we talked about King, and we talked about Davis as candidates to watch, and that's still true this week.
All right. Well, obviously, as we get closer to our primary date, we're going to be talking about all of these races again. Okay, let's move on. The Silent Sam controversy took another curious turn on Wednesday when Superior Court Judge Alan Badeur threw out a deal he had previously approved in November, saying that the Sons of the Confederate Veterans had no right to negotiate it. Badeur gave the UNC Board of Governors until Monday to figure out what they would do with Sam. Rob, the university's got a problem here. On the one hand, they can't give it away because nobody has rights of ownership to it. And on the other hand, if they move it back to the campus at Chapel Hill, they're going to get all kinds of grief from the university committee. What are they going to do?
Well, first thing to be said is that it wasn't a curious decision. The judge was right. Judge Badeur got the decision right. He made a mistake before in approving the settlement. He came back and looked at it. The room was full of UNC supporters and parts of the UNC community who were not going to stand for him to rule that agreement with this fraudulent group was going to go through. As far as what happens to the statue now, it's in a warehouse somewhere. That's probably where it needs to stay, or maybe it gets shuffled off to a battlefield somewhere, but it's not coming back to the campus.
I watched the stream of this hearing, and quite frankly, Judge Bedour at times seemed uncertain and tentative to it. But let me make sure I got this straight, Joe. The same judge that approved the deal in November is now saying that they can't make it because the Sons of Confederate Veterans had no standing. Why did he approve it in November?
Consistency is a hobgoblin of a lot of people. Here's what I think ought to happen. I think they ought to put the statue back where it was to follow the law. Then I think they ought to build a four-sided marble pyramid around the statue. That way, they follow the law. People who are upset by the vision of the can't see it. And in 6 years from now, few people will even know who's entombed in that pyramid on campus.
But it will be back.
It will, in my opinion, it should be because
well,
that's what the law
is.
That's the law.
Yeah, all right. Well, Bev, the judge asked him to come back Monday and tell him what he's going to do, what they're going to do, what the university was going to do with all this stuff. What do you think they're going to do? What are their options?
I'm just frustrated with it. I don't think it should be a point of contention. If I were on the Board of Governors or Chancellor at the university, maybe Chair of the Board of Trustees, I would stand up and say, the statute is in storage. That's where it's going to stay. It's not coming back here. And if I were at Carolina, I would say, over my dead body, is it coming back here? Put me in jail. I think the Board of Governors should do the same thing. This is a ridiculous conversation when they should be focusing on educating our young people and our adult learners. Just get over it, and maybe the General Assembly will have some sense.
I would come visit you in your orange jumpsuit.
Well, I would go on this one. It's just ridiculous.
John, they set up a trust fund for this thing, $2.5 million. And Judge Bedour was particularly interested in knowing what had happened to the money. According to the hearing, it was reported that $52,000 had been paid to the judge representing
the lawyers.
Yeah.
I doubt Judge Bedour was paid off by the Sons of Confederate Veterans.
Okay.
Let's not start a conspiracy
theory.
Here.
All right. So he paid the lawyers.
Yep.
Is that a big deal?
Not really. I actually think the Sons of Confederate Veterans, given that there was initial ruling in their favor and then it went back the other way, they might even have some legal arguments of their own, but they're going to drop it. Everybody's going to drop it on the I don't think you're going to get the money back, and I don't think there's going to be any additional legal action. I do think that the law is pretty clear that the statute now has to go back to McCorkle Price. So as y'all were saying, if you don't want to follow the law, you don't want to follow the law, you're breaking the law. The legislature is the only actor in this story that can change the law. Some of the lawyers and some of the UNC faculty that just made, I thought, a pretty good argument that the settlement was flawed in a variety of ways, those process obstacles, then turned around and said, now let's invent all these ridiculous explanations as to why the law doesn't apply. For example, saying, well, it was torn down illegally, therefore the law no longer applies to it and it can stay in the warehouse. Obviously, we can't have a decision, separate from what you think about the statue, where we let people take the law into their own hands, tear something down, and because they tore it down, it's no longer protected by
God
law.
Forbid,
that's
what
also
would happen
out of the
if
question.
We chase that rabbit. Rob, one of the things that was really, I think, interesting in this whole thing was that your organization and a lot of other organizations seem to be most upset not with the deal that was made, but with the fact that the Board of Governors did it in closed session.
Well, I mean, there were lots of problems with this decision. First of all, again, the Sons of Confederate Veterans had no real legal right to sue in this case. They didn't have standing. They had no real ownership interest in the property. So that the
lawsuit
was...
Why didn't they have it in November? Or was it just not questioned?
It was one of those deals where it was just slipped in quietly behind closed doors.
It was an inclusive
settlement, basically. Right. The two parties negotiated it and just presented to the judge as a fait accompli. And he said, oh, okay, that sounds good to me. Obviously, once the facts came out, nobody was going to stand for that. Just as nobody's going to stand for the thing going back. The law may say that you know, you can't remove it. It's not going back.
All right, so I want to go around the table very quickly and get you to tell me what do you think is going to happen. Joe, you've got the sarcophagus idea pretty well covered here, but really and truly, what do you think is going to happen?
I hope that's exactly what happens.
All right.
I'm not being funny about this.
I didn't say you were being funny. All right, John?
I think the legislature is going to have to take action because otherwise the statute has to go back and you cannot allow people to break the law without consequences.
Beth?
The legislature took action. That's why we have the ridiculous law to start with. And I would think that whomever makes the decision, I would hope that they would say, no, it's not coming back
and
here.
And see, part of the problem was Badur gave them until Monday to tell them what to do. Well, the Board of Governors doesn't even meet until next Thursday and Friday.
Maybe they can grow some leadership and stand up and say no.
They seem to make plenty of decisions without meeting as a board. They make them in secret and small groups get together. Maybe they'll do it again.
Well, speaking of those UNC Board of Governors, they're also under the microscope with a growing number. They're demanding our state change the way members are selected and set firm guidelines outlining their duties. Senator Richard Burr and former UNC President Erskine Bowles, who are often on opposite sides of political issues, authored an op-ed piece in which they said that our university, for the university to maintain excellence, we needed to address the governance issue. That was closely followed by a piece by Lou Bissett, longtime Board of Governors member, proposing what could be done. Bowles and Burr listed 2 points that need to be addressed here. The first is to improve the makeup of the board. What changes would you recommend?
I think that's the best idea I've ever heard. It should have stayed the way the statute had it initially. There was a requirement in the law for a certain number of the majority party, whomever controlled the legislature, but there were also requirements for the minority party, for women, for people who are brown and black descent. There were rural, urban, there was just a great mixture that represented the state of the North Carolina. This university system is not a political pawn. It's not something to be picked over and politicized over. It's the institution.
The case could be made that it's turned into
that. Well, that's how I feel. It has turned into that. But the principle of educating the folks who attend that school is too important. It's the first university in the country. This is ridiculous, again, to have a politicized Board of Governors. And you see from East Carolina what happens when you do.
We'll get to that in a minute. Joe Lou Bissett wrote, I thought, a pretty good piece in Higher Ed Works, in which he said, of the 24 members of the Board of Governors, only 2 live west of Charlotte.
Right.
Only 3 are persons of color. Only 5 are women. The legislature appoints the Board of Governors. Do we need to change who selects them?
No, the university system belongs to the General Assembly. However, I've said before on this show that each one of the 16 universities ought to have a member on the board statutorily required, and that member should either be or have been a member of that local board of trustees. Then after that, political appointees by the General Assembly. That way, there would be demographics, there would be color, and I think there would be a wide range.
Assuming you had that on university boards.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, Rob, the issue here is we got a 24-member board. If you got 16 of them, do we need to go back to having 32 members again?
Maybe. The clear... Okay, I thought I lost the microphone there for a second. The clear problem that we face is that this board is not reflecting the state of North Carolina. It doesn't reflect the young people who go to the university. Governor Perdue is absolutely right. We need the diversity to be reflected in the board. And if it needs to go to 32 to make that happen, we also need to think about diversifying who appoints the board. The governor should play a role. It shouldn't just perhaps be the General Assembly.
Well, Bill Friday railed about that when in 1972 when Bob Scott rammed that through in getting the consolidated university process. We need a law? Do we need legislation to do that, John?
I don't think we should have in law a variety of different quota requirements. Other than, and I've kind of liked Joe's idea, which gets you pretty close to that direction anyway by just focusing on campuses, making sure that each campus is represented by someone. It's even interesting, as Joe was talking about, that you have to serve on a board of trustees first. That would sort of act as a screening device
like
for people
that
who have no experience in university governance. I sort of think that might be a good idea. And I think in practice, not necessarily in law, but in practice, all these diversity considerations should absolutely be part of the conversation.
Ben, one of the things that Bissett or Burr and Bowles, I can't remember which, brought out was that we also ought to have some provision that there can't be conflicts of interest, because we've got a lot of situations where we've got lobbyists who are lobbying the very people who are appointing them, and they in turn have some conflicts with the university.
Right. I agree that the old statute is good in terms of that, too. There was a requirement for years that a lobbyist couldn't serve until maybe 4 or 5 years after they had left the profession of lobbying. And that on its face stopped some of the good old boys network, if you will. I don't think anybody, if you work for higher ed, if you work for one of the companies that does the media and sells the, you shouldn't be able to be on the Board of Governors. There is a conflict of interest, ethics, and morality.
Just as important as to who is on the board is the discussion about what is proper activity to be on that board. We've seen some instances within the last several years where board members got away from their duty of setting policy and got into the interference business, and nowhere was that more evident than the recent trustees at East Carolina University, Rob.
It's quite a mess, and we've got this bizarre phenomenon of Tom Fetzer being on this university governance committee and essentially running a defense team for these people who were on the university, the trustees at ECU, who were engaged in this improper behavior. And Tom's already up to his eyeballs in the mess at ECU, and then he's playing a role on the Board of Governors. It's a huge conflict.
So what should be the
Tom, let me go back to the to composition. The 32 versus the 24 now. If the 16 campuses each have a representative statutorily on the board, then you have between the 16 and the 24 where the General Assembly can leaven the membership, females, people of color, if they need them, that kind of thing.
No, not just if they need them, if they want them. And that's been the issue, is wanting diversity, wanting geographic dispersion and so forth, hadn't it, Beth?
That's the problem right there. Some General Assemblies won't want them. There was a long time where I wasn't wanted, so I think it needs to be required in the statute.
John, let me ask you a question. What is the proper role for the Board of Governors? What should they be involved in?
I would say that the primary purpose of the Board of Governors is to hire a chancellor, replace a chancellor, a president or a chancellor when those leaders need to be hired. That's the primary role of any governance board,
right,
of any entity, is to pick and otherwise support the CEO of the organization, and also to provide independent oversight. I think that it is not a micromanagement position. I think that people have learned over the years when they try to do that, even with the best of intentions, that it doesn't work out very well because they're not in the best position to make those decisions.
$50,000 question. You see the legislature being willing to make any changes on this?
I wouldn't hold my breath. Not this particular General Assembly in the next short session of the General Assembly. I think it's going to happen eventually, but probably not in 2020.
If I held my breath, my face would be as red as my jacket. Let's move on. Recent reports indicate halfway through the state's fiscal year, North Carolina has received some $290 million more in revenue than has been budgeted. Now, coupled with the $900 million in surplus funds that we had from last year that weren't allocated, we already have more than $1 billion in the bank. And that number should swell after the April surprise and the tax returns. Joe Mavretti, with the legislature due to convene April 28th for the short session, and one of their first questions will be what to do with that $1 billion in cash they got. What do you think?
I think they should use it to reduce unfunded liabilities or to give it to DOT to make up money that they need. I think it should be considered one-time money, not recurring.
Interesting. Other comments?
It's mostly one-time money. It's the result of the stock market being up and those kinds of receipts. It's not the result of middle-class incomes rising. It's mostly one-time money. But it does show that we've got a surplus. We do have a surplus of unmet needs in the state as well, and there are a lot of things that money could go to.
But sales tax and income taxes are coming in greater.
This is a broader story than just stock market gains. That's part
everything.
Of it. But also the credit balance actually is much larger than it would be. I think the unreserved credit balance is around $2 billion at this point. So there should be some capital investment, in my view, and there will be if we ever get a budget passed and signed by the governor.
And it is some recurring money because it a lot of it did come from the taxes that we paid. I think you should use some to pay teachers, higher salaries, professors, and then I think the rest should go to the infrastructure, like you're saying. I mean,
but that gets that into the continuation budget.
Some of the money is continuing money because it came from our taxes. The other thing that you're going to hear is give a big tax refund, and that's not a bad idea if you don't care about what's gone wrong in the state in terms of investment for the last 10 years.
Joe, some people are saying that this is all the more reason why we ought to have another round of tax cuts.
I don't think that's a good enough reason, but I do think that a token contribution to unfunded accrued liabilities sends a very clear message to the market
Yeah, what is it we've got? Something like $40 billion?
Yeah, it depends on how you value the pension fund, but it's a large number. I think actually more than a token investment in the account that's already been created for unfunded liabilities would be a good idea.
Yep. All right. That's certainly something that we're going to be talking about as we get into this short session. Let's move on. Mike Reagan, our Secretary of Environmental Quality, recently wrote an op-ed piece in which he said that climate change is the single biggest challenge we face, and the impacts of our state are sobering. Reagan says that rising sea levels, warmer temperatures, more intense storms accompanied by threats of increased flooding dictate we need to take action now. John, Reagan affirms the Cooper administration's clean energy plan for reducing greenhouse gases by 40% by 2025, 70% by 2030. We got 5 years to hit that first mark. How are we doing?
We're doing fine. I mean, when they set the goal, they knew it was already going to be met. It was not a very meaningful goal because it had already been dropping since 2000. I don't think his plan is very sensible, but the goal is fine because it is consistent with the trends, which is primarily a natural gas-driven trend. Solar's become 4% of our mix. It used to be 2.5%. It's a little bit of the story, but the vast majority of the story is fracked natural gas replacing coal. That reduces emissions.
We've made a lot of gains in solar power due to the tax incentive programs that we've given to individuals and to businesses. My understanding is that much of those incentives have expired. Is that correct?
I think that's right.
Yeah. Should we renew them?
I think so. I mean, I think that it's clear that it's not just climate change we're talking about here. We're talking about a climate crisis. This is an existential threat to humanity as we know it.
And Joe,
absolutely.
The Republicans...
It's not an existential threat.
It absolutely
humanity.
Is. It absolutely
absurd.
It's an existential threat to the way humans live today. And, Joe, and if we want to continue to live like we do, we're going to have to make huge changes.
Well, Joe, the Republicans have been imposed to these incentive programs. And for some reason or another, Harry Brown and the members of the Senate are opposed to windmills and wind power. Why?
Well, I think it's a philosophical issue, and I think they're in error. I think there are always startups that need assistance for some period of time, and tax incentive is a way to do it.
Bev, you live down on the coast most of the time, down in Craven County, and I can tell you from being down there fairly frequently, water levels are rising.
They are rising. The mountains
this is important.
The mountains are hotter every year. There's less snow. The coast is, the water's rising. It's hotter. The hottest January in recorded history. So you just get over talking about it not being an existential threat.
None of those things is an existential threat. If we oversell the story, we will never get to a reasonable solution.
I don't believe you can oversell this story.
Of course
you can.
I
think it's the future. It's my grandchildren and great-grandchildren having a place to call home that looks a semblance like it does today.
Joe, you got property
Let's get something concrete here. Geologists at ECU say, from the Virginia border down to Morehead City, all the land east of that, 40% is going to be swamp or marshlands by 2500.
That's right.
80 years. We have a storm every 10 years, a significant storm.
More frequently than that.
So at least. So there's no question that the east of North Carolina is going to be inundated within 80 years.
I'm going to be very, very old by that time. Let's go move to tell us something we don't know. I got 2 minutes in show. Rob?
Chris Nordstrom of NC Justice Center wrote a great piece this week in which he explained that, you know, we've had all these the stories about Leandro, the Leandro West Ed report. It's going to cost billions and billions of dollars. He looked at the numbers. It's actually, if we would just pay our teachers and meet our expenses at the national average, we'd basically meet the West Ed requirements. The real numbers were out $3.6 to $4 billion.
Joe, tell us something we don't know.
Our viewers ought to start paying careful attention to the add-ons to their hospital bills for unnecessary services.
No surprise medical expenses.
Mm-hmm. Too right.
Out-of-patient anesthesiologist. I can talk about that. Bev Perdue, tell us something we don't know.
Trivia. I love trivia. 8,000 hours during a lifetime. We people in America and around the world spend regretting our decisions. That's almost a full year. So when you're making a decision, be intentional because you're going to regret it if you don't.
8,000 hours?
8,000 hours in a lifetime. That's mind-boggling. I'm trying to find decisions I regret so I can sit down and rest.
I love the data.
I thought it was just me. John Hood, tell us something we don't know.
There was a series of earthquakes along the North Carolina-Tennessee border a few days ago. I think it's because all those congressional candidates in the 11th district, they went from one debate to another, and it shifted. It was a seismic shift along the mountains.
Oh, me. That's good. Last weekend, I did moderated a lieutenant governor debate for the Democratic candidates in North Carolina, up in Kannapolis. And if you want to see it, it's on our website. I tested out some new theories for debates. Hopefully, we can change it. Well, you've heard our spin on the issues of the day. To stay informed all during the week, sign up for our free weekly email newsletter, give your feedback, and read my weekly column. Visit our website, ncspin.com, or catch NC Spin on Facebook. While on that website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast and also our YouTube channel. And join us next week when we'll have more balanced debate for the Old North State. Until then, happy Valentine's Day. Stay informed and watch out for the spin.
Today's tools make you a real DIYer, and as a member of an electric cooperative, you have lots of valuable tools to help you do it yourself in controlling your home energy use and budget, leaving you free to be dad.
The big issue in 2020 is healthcare. Let's talk basics. You are the key to your own personal health, but there is strong evidence that if you have a relationship with a family physician, your quality of life will be better. You'll likely live longer, and you'll have 33% lower healthcare costs. Your family doctor knows you, has your medical history, and can quickly diagnose health problems. Family Physicians, your trusted healthcare advisor for life.
Join us next week and get the spin on issues facing our state. For more information or to learn how to contact us, visit our website, ncspin.com. NC Spin is a copyrighted production of Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated.